Welcome back to Sit for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. We've got a great episode for you this week, featuring a COVID double bill. We were joined by Nick Davis from the Institute for Government and Jeffrey Matsu, SIPFA's Chief Economist, to talk about public service preparedness for COVID in a more general sense. We then spoke to Aileen Murphy from the National Audit Office, honing in on the readiness of the NHS and social care in particular for the pandemic. So first and foremost, over to Nick and Jeff. So I'm here today with Jeffrey Matsu, Chief Economist from SIPFA, and Nick Davis from the Institute for Government, both first-timers to the SIPFA podcast. So thank you both for joining us today. So Nick, should we kick off with you? Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about the Institute for Government and your role?
Yes, absolutely. So the Institute for Government is a think tank, and our mission is to improve the effectiveness of government. I am a programme director there, and I oversee our work on public services and outsourcing.
Great, thanks Nick. And Jeff, do you want to give us a bit about your background as well?
So I'm Chief Economist with SIPFA. My goal is to connect policy and practice with a stronger evidence base. The performance tracker is one of the tools that SIPFA uses to do this.
So Jeff touched on the performance tracker there, which is what they've both kindly joined us to talk about today. The last performance tracker was launched in 2019, but we have just released the summer update. The report is exploring how fit public services were for coronavirus, how prepared, how resilient, and how they've managed to cope with the crisis to date. So, Jeff, let's kick off with you. Austerity is a consistent theme throughout the report. What impact would you say austerity had on the ability of public services to respond effectively to the pandemic?
10 years of austerity certainly have had significant impact on both preparedness and resilience for government and public services. This was a deliberate choice that government made. So this isn't something that was just coincidental. This was a deliberate policy intervention to rein public spending after a period which led up to the great financial crisis. When we reflect on how public service preparedness and resilience has been leading up to coronavirus, it's really, really important to just remember why we were in that position to begin with. We've cut public services down to the bone. Unless we're willing to pay more going forward, this is the level of service that we can currently afford.
Just to pick up on that, I agree with all of those points. I don't think there is a single right level of public spending or a correct way to allocate spending. These are all political choices that politicians make and that we vote for. It was a deliberate choice to hold down spending on public services. The alternative would have been taxing more, or indeed we could have spent more on improving the resilience of services, but that might have come at the cost of their day-to-day performance over the last few years. So these are all really difficult trade-offs. However, the choices that were made meant that public services entered the crisis with ailing performance levels, severe staffing pressures, and having underinvested in buildings and equipment, all of which made it harder for services to respond to this crisis.
So you both touched on the funding issues experienced by services there. In recent days, actually, there's been discussion about increased taxation, perhaps for social care contributions for people over the age of 40. Is increased funding the only thing that sits behind this? Is that going to be what solves the problem?
Clearly, funding is a huge part of the performance and resilience of public services. So Performance Tracker, which we published last year, that found that looking over the last 10 years, that while some efficiencies had been made, those efficiencies had largely been made by cutting staff or holding down public sector pay. They were belt tightening measures, and actually they've proved to not be that sustainable. So in more recent years, we've seen above inflation pay rises for public sector staff, and indeed quite legitimate demands for more given what public sector staff have done during the crisis. And we've seen some of those services that saw the deepest staff cuts, like prisons, for example, they've had to recruit lots of new staff because performance levels dropped so much. If there are ways of delivering better quality services for the same amount of money, and you know, that might be through targets or inspections or other management approaches, the government generally hasn't been able to tap into those when it's made its efficiencies in recent years. So yeah, clearly the amount of money we spend is going to be a key determinant of the quality of services that we get.
I would add that it's really important that we live within our means. And I think that was what informed policy action over the past decade in terms of fiscal austerity. If you look at our current position, the deficit for the UK has hit a 300-year high and debt exceeds 100% of GDP. And that's for the first time since the 1960s. these numbers are astronomical. In due course, they will come down, particularly as the economy recovers. But it's really important to keep in mind that spending does need to be funded, and that funding comes from taxes. And that relationship is very clear. It's not so simple in terms of delineating who bears the cost, because we know that the costs and benefits accrue at different points in time and to different people across society. So those decisions aren't easy ones to make. And while you can kick the can down the road, at some point in time, there is a cost to be reckoned with. And particularly when there are a number of unknowns, particularly related to inflation and the cost of interest that debt accrues. These are substantial risks that we just don't have a good grasp of today. And so we just need to keep these things in mind as we spend and as we open up the public purse. And so we do need to have some reflection as to how costs and benefits are apportioned across society.
Nick, interestingly, just a moment ago there, you talked about the performance of prisons and the impact of austerity there. So let's move into the fitness charts that are contained in the new report. They provide a really interesting and useful at-a-glance image of how different services have performed over the course of the current crisis. But the fitness charts indicate that the NHS and prisons were probably the most prepared for the crisis. So what would you say enabled them to be able to deal with the situation better than other services?
In terms of preparedness, we are looking at the existence of plans, the quality of those plans, and the understanding that staff had of their roles and responsibilities in emergencies and their ability to implement those plans. All services we looked at had plans for dealing with emergencies, but those varied greatly in terms of their quality and adaptability. I think probably the most useful plans were held by NHS trusts, police forces, and also local authorities, which are all designated as Category 1 responders under the Civil Contingencies Act, and therefore have a duty to maintain plans on how to continue to perform their normal functions while responding to emergencies. Though, as you said, it was actually probably prisons that had the best quality plans, because those detailed how to keep prisoners isolated in the event of outbreaks of infectious diseases. They were basically very appropriate for the circumstances that prisons have found themselves during coronavirus. I would say some services also benefited from the existence of well-developed command structures. And finally, those services that are most practiced at dealing with emergencies, so prisons and hospitals, but also the police, were probably able to manage the initial lockdown most successfully due to a combination of training, experience, and culture.
So going further into the fitness chart ratings, in terms of which services have come out the worst as far as both resilience and preparedness are concerned, we see specific problems in adult social care. I'd say the findings from the report that CIPFRA and the IFG have published this week very much align with similar reports that have recently come out of the Public Accounts Committee, in the sense that adult social care has experienced some real problems over the last few months. Can you talk me through what underpins your findings in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of preparedness, central government plans for adult social care had not fully implemented the lessons from the last major planning exercise, which was called Exercise Cygnus. It was carried out in 2016. And critically, that found that the social care system would struggle to cope if the NHS implemented its proposed reverse triage plans, whereby patients would be moved from hospitals into social care settings. And indeed, that is exactly what has happened during the crisis. One of the reasons for that was that the government never published the results of Exercise Cygnus, and therefore key organisations such as care homes were unaware of these findings. Furthermore, the communication channels with local government have often been poor, and the diversity of the adult social care market, which can be a benefit in normal times because it enables choice, but that has made it much harder to consistently implement plans across the country. In terms of resilience, 10 years of austerity meant that fewer people were receiving publicly funded care, and that the system was facing serious workforce issues. So with high turnover of staff and vacancies and poor pay and working conditions, and indeed there's been some evidence that poorly paid care staff having to move from setting to setting to setting has helped spread the virus. And tight funding in recent years has also meant that social care providers didn't have PPE stockpiles and hadn't been able to invest in appropriate ICT. The latter made it far harder for those in care homes to see their families remotely. Care homes also didn't have enough spare capacity to enable social distancing.
So, Jeff, coming back to you, Nick obviously mentioned exercise sickness there, but the one of the things that the report does highlight is a real failure to learn lessons from previously conducted exercises, modelling the impact of and response to a flu pandemic. However, it also highlights the dangers of creating really inflexible plans that are tailored to a specific or a past crisis. So moving forward, how can the government balance learning lessons from the current crisis to prepare for a second wave and for future scenarios, but at the same time not be completely inflexible in its planning?
I think what the past two crises, the current one and the great financial crisis, have taught us is that the frequency of low probability, high risk events seems to be increasing. We just don't know what type of high risk event it's going to be. Last time it was triggered by a housing crisis. This time it's been triggered by a health crisis. The next time, we just don't know what that crisis might be. It might be bioterrorism. It might be some kind of cyber attack. We just don't know. And I think what comes out clearly from this performance tracker is that there are two things. One is communication, and the second one is transparency in that communication. We know that both have suffered in recent years. That hasn't been helped by things like our Brexit negotiations and our changes in government. If we reflect back 6 months ago, we were in a position where there was still a lot of turmoil in terms of how government was structured, let alone how government departments were speaking to each other. So in that sense, communication and transparency are things that stretch across time. And I don't think that it can be just a single exercise. I think it needs to be something that is embedded more deeply across how government is structured. No matter what was done in terms of exercise sickness or any other type of preparedness exercise, if government itself has communication strategies that are not synced together, and if government itself chooses a platform which deliberately is not as transparent as it could be, then any type of emergency preparedness plan is still going to have holes in it. So I think it's really, really important that we hold government to account throughout the year and across different governments to ensure that these communication structures are transparent and resilient. And I think maybe that is maybe the perhaps the biggest shortfall that we have had going into this crisis.
A fair amount of what Jeff said there actually is quite ominous. So the increasing prevalence of these high-risk events, bioterrorism, cyber threats. I mean, goodness me, I wonder how I'm going to sleep this evening. But and then talking about that, there are some real potential barriers to being able to effectively learn and implement lessons from these crises as a result of government structures and changes needing to be made there. Nick, is there room for optimism?
I hope there's always room for optimism. And frankly, I'm not sure I've got much more capacity for many more cataclysms this year. I completely agree with what Jeff said. There are some well understood communication channels, but the government has not always used them, in particular senior ministers, and particularly those ministers making announcements as part of the daily press conferences. So, you know, we heard as part of our research that local authorities or frontline services, but even departments, often wouldn't know about an announcement until the minister uttered it at the 5 p.m. press conference. Clearly, that makes it far harder to effectively implement or even to understand what's being said, because sometimes the guidance associated with that announcement wasn't released until days or weeks later. And I think partly that's part of this kind of government's approach. This current group of ministers, or particularly those at the top, tend to be quite skeptical of outside advice. They tend to like to stick in a fairly tight group, and that's worked very well in campaigns. It's less effective for government. And I think it's also notable that some of the key ministers were not involved in previous exercises. This current group of cabinet ministers are very new. They've got very little experience in these senior roles, and none of them had taken part in Operation Cygnus, which is why we recommend that government should conduct more regular planning exercises, and that particularly the Prime Minister and the Health Secretary should probably take part in such an exercise within 6 months of taking office. In terms of transparency, completely agree. So we think that all public bodies should be publishing their plans for dealing with with emergencies, as well as the key findings from planning exercises associated with those, which is going to improve scrutiny. And another way that you can improve scrutiny is by having select committees paying more attention to scrutinizing departmental plans and any kind of shortcomings that have been identified in exercises. Looking ahead, as we all touched upon at the beginning, there is a trade-off between resilience, efficiency, and the level of taxation everyone is paying. There's no right answer, but that is a live discussion. It's going to be a particularly live discussion in the upcoming spending review. And we think that as part of that, government should be assessing the ability of staffing, equipment, and buildings to cope with scenarios that are identified in government emergency plans. And frankly, if the government wants its public services to be more resilient, then it's going to have to spend more.
And I think that's an excellent note to end on. So thank you very much, Nick and Jeff, for joining us on the podcast today. And everybody should check out the latest performance tracker summer update. There will be links in the description. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Nick Davis from the Institute for Government and Jeff Matsu from SIPFA on the preparedness of public services for COVID-19. Up next, we spoke to Aileen Murphy with a deep dive into health and social care. So I'm here with Aileen Murphy from the National Audit Office. How are you today, Aileen?
Oh, I'm fine, Ashley. Thank you. And thank you for being interested in our work.
No problem at all. And thank you so much for joining us. So for our listeners who may not have come across you before, you're a first timer to the podcast. Could you tell them a bit about your role with the National Audit Office and what it entails?
So I am one of the NAO's Value for Money directors. I've been in post for an embarrassingly long time. And for the last 7 years, I've been responsible for the Value for Money audit of MHCLG and its programmes. And I also lead on our work in local government, which we do under a separate set of statutory powers post the abolition of the Audit Commission. So I've been in and around the sector for a bit. Thematically speaking, our work has divided into financial sustainability, a lot of on the financial position of the sector, most recently looking at commercial investments, a lot on adult social care, starting with an overview in 2014. And we've also done a lot of work on devolution and local economic growth.
So in line with some of those themes that you've talked about in the finance sector, of course, you've also had a big programme of work underway recently around COVID. And we'll touch on some of the stuff you've got coming down the tracks towards the end of this chat. But back in June, you released a report, readying the NHS and adult social care in England for COVID-19. So honing in on the health sector to start with, overall, it seems they were able to respond fairly quickly and effectively to COVID.
Yeah, if I just give a little bit of background about what that report focused on, if you don't mind. Given the size and extent of the pandemic and therefore the government response to it, the head of the NAO, Gareth Davis, took a decision quite early on that we wanted to produce work that talked about what actually happened, because I think there's a lot about clarity and transparency, what money's being spent, who's doing what, etc. So the readying the NHS and adult social care report takes the letter from the chief exec, Simon Stevens, on the 17th of March that says, NHS, do all these things, please. Some of that was for social care, of course, to do with discharge. And also the adult social care action plan from the 15th of April and says, OK, here are all these commitments. What actually happened? Who did what and what money got spent? So that was the premise of the report. Get back to your question. The NHS did really well on increasing its capacity very quickly. And that was done through the creation of the Nightingale Hospitals. I'm sorry, I never feel like we should say building a Nightingale Hospitals because the buildings were there, weren't they? But, you know, so creating a health function, if you like, out of unpromising material like the XL Exhibition Centre. So increasing its capacity that way, increasing its ventilator capacity and oxygen supply. The beds were never more than 50% full at the height of the pandemic in April. Obviously bringing online capacity from the private sector. There's another 8,000 beds came in there. So with those three things, beds, oxygen, additional capacity, the NHS did well.
It would seem from the report that the main thing impacting on the NHS's ability to respond were mostly around historic financial sustainability issues. So could the health sector have been on a more secure footing coming into this crisis, and would that have helped at all?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the head of our organisation pointed out in his foreword, that just because you're dealing with a pandemic doesn't mean to say that you can start with a clean slate. You're dealing with all the problems that you had going into the pandemic. And one of those was, of course, that both health and local government have been under financial and demand pressures for a long time, since 2010. Although, as I always say in defence of my local government colleagues to NHS staff, you haven't had any cuts. Cuts are where you get less money, not more. The NHS has had cash uplifts. Now, it might not have been as much as they would have liked or to keep up with demand pressures, but nevertheless, they have had them. But the service was under pressure, as we've reported annually in our NHS financial sustainability work. You know, the historic financial weakness of certain NHS trusts, for instance, is all laid out in those reports. So yeah, that's one issue. And I think the other issue too was about the actual structure of the service. This is not something we've reported on, so I suppose it's more my view than an NEO one. But the whole internal market, the fact that NHS England is an agency at one remove from the department, which was done to make it an apolitical organisation. All of those things are great. But, you know, in a pandemic, you then need a big shout from the top and a clear line of sight to the front line. So I think that having to put those kind of ways of operating into play quickly must have been a challenge.
You touched on the fact there that obviously local government has experienced cuts over a number of years, and it's clear from the headlines and from your report that social care has been struggling, not assisted by a sudden influx of demand from the rapid discharge of patients from hospital. So what would you see as the main issues that have been faced by social care? Obviously the Public Accounts Committee have touched on this as well.
The biggest issues for adult social care as a sector are the fact that it has had, in despite the demographic rise in the number of frail elderly people and also the number of people aged 18 to 64 with multiple conditions, you know, who will never work and have survived childhood where they wouldn't have in previous generations. All of those led to pressure on the service side of adult social care. And on the finances, we know that money has not kept pace with demand. Jobs have not kept pace with demographic demand either, so that the service was already creaking before the pandemic. And in some areas, we had providers walking away from contracts because they didn't think they were viable. That was in both domiciliary, primarily in domiciliary care. The problems there are in getting complex care packages arranged, you know, leads you to think that this is not a market that's functioning as well as it could do, you know, for particular groups of people. So that's one issue. And then you have the problem, the structural problem, that it is actually just incredibly disaggregated. You know, it's a service which is anywhere up to 20,000 providers, some very big, some national chains, some very small. Provision, it varies locally, and it's commissioned through local authorities. So it's a very different kind of service to put on an emergency footing than, you know, a pyramid like the NHS with a big shout from the top.
And looking on the bright side, obviously, the pandemic has forced health and social care systems to work more closely together through necessity. We've seen some good examples of more joined up working and a move towards the move towards integration, I suppose. But your report indicates that health and social care integration has been a tough nut to crack for decades. Do you think that the pandemic could be the catalyst needed to finally propel it forward?
Well, I certainly think where integration was working already, and in a report on the interface between adult social care and health in July 2018, we pointed to a number of places that had various things underway that were helping, you know, like the localized integration of services. I would hope so, but I think that the work you have to do in responding to an emergency situation compared with, you know, the ongoing care of people who maybe will never get better and will need care for the rest of their lives from the health service, from community health services, from GPs, from adult social care, is still a difficult nut to crack. And I think that what we've got to think about is what's the organising principle that best suits a system like that. And it's not one where, you know, a national solution is imposed from Whitehall. It is about focusing services around the needs of the individual and giving the individual much more autonomy. I'm a big fan of personal budgets and you know, increasing autonomy for individuals. It usually gives you benefits in terms of the outcomes. It's certainly, people like it better. And just occasionally, it gives you savings as well. So it's kind of win-win for everyone. So I think you've got to think about what approaches there are that suit an emergency situation, but what we need to do longer term to make this work for everyone. Because it's really about the historic split in 1948 with the NHS going one way and social care under the National Assistance Act going another. And for the last 20 years, there's been a multitude of commissions and green papers, white papers, etc., that have tried to deal with that, and none of them have stuck. But all of them, interestingly, have the same goal, everything from the Sutherland Commission onwards. And you're far too young to remember the Sutherland Commission.
Well, the government have talked about bringing in, moving straight from a social care green paper onto a white paper. That, in theory, should be, well, I suppose the social care green paper has been imminent any day now. But in theory, there's a white paper coming down the track. Is there hope for what might be contained in that?
Yeah, I mean, the social care green paper, for a while, I began to think it's really the public service equivalent of Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, isn't it? But having said that, yeah, I mean, the thing is, in policy terms, you have to work out what is a public service obligation that we'll pay for out of general taxation and what lies with the individual. Now, on the health side, we made a decision as a nation a long time ago to say all that is going to lie on the taxpayer, you know, apart from, you know, there are things, of course, that one pays for, like glasses, etc. Now, the issue there is to settle that for social care. And that needs a policy answer. And I think, too, it needs a differentiated policy answer depending on the age of the individuals as well. You know, because, and I need to declare an interest here because I'm getting on a bit, but it may well be that, you know, putting up taxes for the under 40s so they build up their own fund like you do in Japan might be one answer. There might be another answer for people like me that are getting towards an age where you might be thinking about retiring. And also the way that you fund it from what tax source is really important. Because at the moment it's sourced from local government finance, so that means it comes through council tax and business rates, neither of which are the same across the country, and they're not tied up with local need either. So that's problematic as a tax source. You've got to think about that too.
Yeah, so it's going to remain a tough nut to crack for some time, but we can but hope.
And I think there are a lot of really, really good examples around the place. I think if you look at, say, Tameside, Greater Manchester, the joint commissioning fund they have, and the fact that the chief exec of the local authority is now the chief exec of the CCG. I think that's really interesting and a good example of where, you know, that really does structurally bring everything together. But one of the issues about this, and I've presented on this on a number of occasions, as you can tell because I'm going on a bit, is that legislation in this area is seen as something to be got round, and legislation for me should be facilitative. So we need to think again about the way that services are financed and the institutional barriers that make it difficult to work together on the ground. And then there are some very sort of straightforward, or seemingly straightforward solutions like multidisciplinary teams, where it doesn't matter what agency you work for, you know, you all come together for the care of individuals, a group or a geographical area. So there's lots of different ways forward, I think. And I think the provider voice is a really one that should be at the table as well. And it very often isn't.
I think that's a really kind of positive place to kind of start to loop back to the beginning of our conversation. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that idea of legislation being facilitative. That's a really nice thought. So back at the beginning, we talked about the programme of work that the NAO are doing around COVID. Yep. So to conclude, I suppose, is there anything else coming down the track anytime soon that people should be looking out for?
Yes. So I talked at the beginning about what had gone well in terms of the NHS was never overwhelmed, which was a big fear at the time, at the start of the pandemic. So that's good. What didn't work out well was the fact that the social care action plan took a month to come into place. So it was always kind of looking like an afterthought. So I think for me, I think one of the things we need to see is that social care actually has its place at the top table of policy making at DHSC. I think that's very important. Another thing that didn't work well was PPE supplies, both to health and social care staff. So we've got a report ongoing at the moment on the supply of PPE. Testing, again, is still problematic. So do we have the right testing facilities in place? Again, social care staff are a month behind the NHS in being eligible, for example. And I think, as the report makes clear, not testing people before they were discharged from hospital was what the MPs described as an appalling error, and discharging them into care homes. So we've got work just beginning on contact tracing and testing. We also have a piece of work on the ventilator challenge, and I'm looking at adult social care markets and the COVID pandemic and what that tells us about the state of the market and what we need to do about it. So that's enough to be going on with, isn't it?
Absolutely. It seems like there's a lot coming down the track. Listeners, you'll be able to find more information on where to find the NAO's reports in the description below.
If you look at the size of the problem and the size of the government's response, I think it's going to keep the NAO busy for quite a long time. As well as that, we're tracking the cost of COVID. We're going to have a monthly tracker on our website where, you know, if you want to know how much has been spent, say, on the jobs retention scheme, you can just go there and look at it.
Brilliant. Well, as you say, it does sound like you're going to have plenty to keep you busy. So thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Sit for Speaks, and that is the end of our show. Thanks again to all of our speakers. You'll find links to the resources and reports that were discussed in the description below, and we'll see you next time.